Good evening and welcome to episode 65 of the Deck Tees podcast, brought to you by LegitMTG.com. My name is Aaron Campbell. My guest tonight is a Hall of Famer. He is a blogger. He is a commentator. He's a rapper. He's an author. He's a husband. Is there anything he doesn't do? Well, we're about to find out tonight. Hello, Patrick Chapin.
Hello.
Hi. You have quite the resume.
That's quite the entrance. I don't know how to... Thanks for having me. That is quite a presentation there.
Well, I'm just trying to do you justice. That's really all it is. I actually feel like I left something out. Like, did we cover all the bases? I mean, did I forget anything?
I'm a video game designer.
Okay. See, I didn't even do you justice, and that's what I was trying to do. So now I feel bad.
Semi-professional dancer.
You're a dancer.
I'm a retired dancer. Well, I still dance, but no longer in quite as professional of a capacity.
Okay, so are we talking ballroom, swing?
I would say experienced in quite a bit, but only usually recruited for hip hop dancing type gigs.
Are you saying you twerk?
I mean, I don't know that the word twerk even means anything more. It kind of has been hijacked. Mm-hmm. I generally would not twerk,
okay. But
I could twerk if, you know, the occasion called for it.
Okay, so you would be what they call the twerky. You'd be the one that's twerked upon.
That's for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that's actually just what we call it Tuesday.
Oh. Twerking Tuesday with Patrick Chapin. That sounds like an event I'd celebrate. Just throwing that out there.
All right.
Well, I'm very happy that you are here. Like I said, you are one of the biggest names that I've had on in a while, and I've heard so much about you, and I followed you for a little bit, and we do have some mutual friends, and they've all said some great things about you, and I'm looking to experience that.
You read some of my tweets, and you were like, definitely unfollowing. Boom.
No, I tend to be the one that scares people off with the tweets because I do tweet a lot and I'm also very uncensored and I also have a bit of a tilting problem. So, you know, there are times where I get a little tilt happy and I'll admit I've scared a couple of people off, but I usually have a very high tolerance for people. In fact, I think you're one of the people, the only reason I didn't follow you, Patrick, is I felt like you didn't tweet enough. And again, I wanted to see so much more from you and I just felt like I wasn't seeing enough. So that's why I didn't follow you.
I see. Yeah, I was just recently having a conversation with a couple of good friends of mine, Tom Martell and Eric Froelich. We don't know anybody who tilts a lot, so it's kind of something I'd like to know more about.
Yeah, it's funny because I've been really good. I haven't tilted in about a week. I've been trying something new to try to curb that. And it's funny when people say that because I've talked about my tilt very openly on the show and I've asked other people how they handle it. And the feedback that I've gotten from my listeners, it's not that they're upset about it or it's not that they're bothered by it, but they're like, we've never heard anybody talk about it like you have, own it like you have, and really just face it the way that I have. Like I really feel like I've tried to intimately get to know it. And if I can, you know, understand it better, or maybe I can beat it. And people find it really fascinating for some reason. So I've heard that before too.
Well, I think there's something inherently very appealing about somebody who is self-aware, you know, mm-hmm. Like self-awareness is very powerful.
Yeah. And it's always been something I think people don't talk enough about. Like, I feel like a lot of the articles that people have devoted to tilt, to sum it up, it's basically don't tilt. And it's like, well, that's not that easy to do. I think there's a lot of, you know, root causes for it. And I think especially on the individual level, you know, why I tilt may not be why you tilt and how we choose to deal with it and the triggers. And it's a complex thing. We're going to turn the tables and talk about you. So I do research on all of my guests. And when I was doing research on you, I watched... I prefer, what is it they say, affectionately watching or lovingly observing. There we go. I got that from the movie Closer. It's a good movie. You should see it sometime. But I watched the video. You have a Hall of Fame video. It's a profile of you. And Rich Hagen said, and I quote, "I don't think anyone says magic community more than that man. He's done more for the world of magic than anyone in the whole world." What does it feel like to hear something like that?
I guess it's... humbling. Mm-hmm. It's it's very, you know, very strong praise from a man I have a great deal of respect for, and in an area that it means a lot that somebody would care. Mm-hmm. Because the thing that I have most dedicated my adult life to has been the Magic community and trying to expand it, make it bigger, make it more fun, more accepting, involve more people, and people get more out of it and be more of what people want it to be. And then it's, you know, I absolutely love it. And as a somebody who has poured so much time and energy into it, it feels good whenever there's another person who values some of the same things, you know?
So how important would you say the community is to you? Like, if you were to prioritize everything you're doing in Magic, like, you know, the winning, the deck building and everything like that, where would you say the community falls in that spectrum?
Yeah, it's the most. That's the entire point.
Right.
I mean, the entire point is that, I mean, like, the deck building, the playing games, the drafting, the being at tournaments, the articles, the books, like, everything, it's kind of just a way to experience elements of the community. I mean, the Magic community has changed my life for the better in so many ways and is by far the greatest source of enrichment in terms of experiences, in terms of enjoyment, in terms of just incredible, awesome people. It is just unbelievable. The people, like, so people in like your people that I encounter in everyday life compared to people that I encounter in the Magic community, it is unbelievable how awesome of a filter the very fact that somebody is in the Magic community is for immediately bringing to me people that are highly likely to be intelligent and interesting and come from a, you know, varied backgrounds and have so many different life experiences, but at the same time a common bond and a common language to be able to connect to me. And that's, I mean, that is an incredible source of life. It's a way to, it is the thing that brings the most in the most life to me and makes me experience the most life.
That's a really great way to put it. The game also makes a really good icebreaker. I think you said it that way too, where, you know, people that you would normally not have anything in common with, or you would think you don't, you know, the minute you hear that they play Magic, it's like, oh, we've got something. And then you sort of build off of that. And that's something I've enjoyed about the game is meeting people and getting to know people that I probably wouldn't give a shot to otherwise. But having the game, you know, build that bridge has really helped us establish a friendship.
In the last 24 hours, I've had a conversation with somebody in Brazil, somebody in Germany, and somebody in France. And I work at a place where, I mean, it is just incredible to have been, like, Luis Scott Vargas sits next to me at work. You know, like, having these incredible people from all over the world and all over different parts of, you know, just different facets of life being brought together and to have these close relationships and relationships of all sorts, you know? So, yes. And it's not even just, you know, at that level, even just at a surface introductory level. I can't even, I mean, it's unimaginable just how many people I've met that I don't know them at all. I've never met them before. But they play Magic and I play Magic, and instantly we have so much connection, so much community, not just a common language, but a shared set of experiences. There are a bunch of things we both care about that have overlap. We can relate to events in the past, and we have prospects in the future that our paths will be interwoven in the future, you know?
Yeah, and I definitely want to talk about your journey, Patrick, because I feel like you – how you got here today is very interesting, and it's very inspirational in a lot of ways. And I feel like your story is very unique, and I really wanted to share that with people and hope they can take something away from it as well. So to get started,
completely unique. I mean, Robert Downey Jr. went through some similar things.
Are you comparing yourself to Robert Downey Jr., Patrick Chapin?
No. If anything, Breaking Bad.
Oh, man. Okay, so you came up through the ranks in something called the Juniors Division, along with several other pros that we know and love. What exactly is the Juniors Division? Because I don't believe they have that anymore.
Yeah, so when the first year of the Magic Pro Tour, first year and a half, actually it was for the first 2 years, I guess, there was a Junior Division at the Pro Tour. And the Junior Division, basically the way they had it set up is that there was an Adult Pro Tour and a Junior Pro Tour. And the Adult Pro Tour had cash prizes, and the Junior Pro Tour had the same level of prizes, but in scholarship money.
Oh.
And the Junior Division was for people who 18 and under, and the Adult Division was for, presumably it was for people too old for the Junior Division. And that was the way that it was phrased to us in the beginning. But eventually it became clear that the Prestige was attached to the adult division. And as a result, the best juniors left the junior division and went up and played in the adult division. Mm-hmm. At the time, during the first year of the Pro Tour, it was strange because so much focus got paid to the adult division mm-hmm. when the junior division was actually significantly stronger. And just to give you an idea of the type of people who were coming up during the junior, you know, in the junior division, quote unquote, there's John Finkel, Zvi Maushevitz, Brian Kibler, Kai Budit. It's like not even close. Whereas the adult division, I mean, like just to see the difference between the two, at the first Pro Tour, the Necropotence decks in the adult division were lucky if they had a Demonic Consultation at all. Mm-hmm. Whereas the junior division was playing four Necropotences with demonic, like with tons of Demonic Consultations, because they were stronger players. Mm-hmm. But that didn't last very long because quickly all the juniors that were good moved up to the adult division. Mm-hmm. I started playing during the first year of the Pro Tour, which was in 1996. Mm-hmm. Or I started playing on the Pro Tour. I played Magic, you know, long before that. But in 1996, they made the Pro Tour, and I tried to qualify for the first tournament that I'd actually be able to go to, because at the time I was 15 and couldn't really travel, you know, super easy. Mm-hmm. But I tried playing in a PTQ for Pro Tour Dallas, and back then, juniors and adults just played together in PTQs.
Yeah.
And you just said at the beginning of the tournament, are you an adult or a junior? And then you would just win one or the other. And I think like the top eight or top four or whatever would be segregated by adult or junior. But won the first PTQ I played in, went to Dallas, and ended up finishing third at that one. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of just snowballed from there. I only ended up going to one more junior Pro Tour, though. At the next junior Pro Tour, I ended up finishing 11th. Mm-hmm. And then decided to switch to the adult division. The rest is history. At some point, the junior division was replaced with the junior super series mm-hmm. for a while, which was given more exposure than the junior division was. However, the prize structure was, you know, fairly different, but that was eventually abandoned as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I say, from what I understand, we don't have the juniors division anymore, and it sounds like it really helped you get involved in the game that way, and it makes me almost kind of wish we still had that. Would you agree with that?
I guess it's sort of – to say that it helped me is kind of strange, though, because I would have rather have been in the adult division the whole time. Mm-hmm. For me personally, I mean, in Dallas, I would have greatly preferred. I mean, like for instance, right now I have only four top eights according to the official records because that one was in the quote unquote junior division. So even though it had as many players and as many rounds and it was as tough and it doesn't, you know, it's because it was separated into two different events. Mm-hmm. Both events meant less,
right?
You know, and in particular the junior division. So I personally, I'm a fan of there being, of the two being merged, mm-hmm. but I also am a fan of there being activities and programs and things specifically targeting juniors.
Right. Now, if you were to, if I'm understanding it correctly, if there was no juniors program and you were that age again, would you still have been able to play competitive Magic before 18?
Yeah, which is what I did.
Okay.
I actually switched over to the adult division as soon as I wanted to.
Oh, really? So there wasn't like an age requirement to do that?
No, the only age requirement is that you can't be over 18 and play in the junior division. The adult division had no requirements.
Okay, see, I thought that like, there was a certain age requirement, and until you hit that age, you had to stay in juniors.
No. My first adult top eight was when I was 16.
Okay. That makes sense. I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand that.
Oh, yeah. No. It wasn't set up so that you had to be 18 in order to play as an adult, mm-hmm. which in, you know, and obviously today you don't have to be 18. Our world champion is only, you know, he was only 19 years old when he won the world championship and he's been good for a number of years.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So after some success in the competitive scene, you became the first ever R&D intern for Wizards in the early 2000s. Tell me about that.
They had been trying to recruit me, you know, earlier than that. Mm-hmm. It always kind of, you know, just mentioned that whenever I graduated from high school, if I wanted to come out and I ended up taking them up on it in 2002. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in 2002. So at that point I was 21, 22, something like that, and they, you know, it, like I had already been doing a lot of design stuff where, like, for years and years and years, I always would bring custom-made sets to pro tournaments or to pro tours and Grand Prix and just, you know, just draft with people with custom sets that I had made up and share any ideas I had with anybody who would listen.
Had you
I've always enjoyed designing Magic cards, you know.
Right. Had you been to college at all, or was it literally high school, this, and then this opportunity?
Well, no. I mean, I did this when I was 21 or 22,
Okay.
and I went. I graduated from high school when I was 17,
Sure.
and then I went to college for a year and a half before I dropped out
Okay.
to not go to college anymore.
Was that something you ever regret missing out on?
No, I didn't want to go to college in the first place.
Kibler was kind of the same way. I remember when I interviewed him, he had basically indicated that he sort of, slacked a little bit in that area. And I was like, what a great message for the Magic players listening,
Well, no, let me be, let, I guess, you know, if, well, I got a moment. If I can just be completely blunt,
Sure.
one of the greatest decisions I ever made was dropping out of college. I think that, you know, and this isn't to say to drop out of school entirely, you know, or that it's right for everybody, but I know that there's, like, when I was growing up, there was this incredible pressure on everybody. Oh, you have to go to school as much as you can, and that's the most important thing. And if you get a degree, everything just works out great. And then what ends up happening is people end up, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in debt for student loans,
Four
and they end up with
hundreds.
and they end up with a piece of paper, a degree, and it's like, what is this degree even worth now? Because everybody has access to degrees. It's not even like some impressive thing anymore. I mean, a degree used to be an impressive thing, but because of the way student loans are now subsidized for everybody to be able to go, degrees are a dime a dozen. So then it became, well, then everybody needs a master's degree. But then once everybody starts getting a master's degree, you end up in spots where people spend 6 years at college getting a master's degree, and then they're surprised that their jobs aren't just magically there. Whereas people who are out doing things in the world, gaining experiences, you know, they're off doing something else.
Right.
And I certainly think that college is an awesome, awesome thing for an awful lot of people. And for me in particular, I really enjoyed the social element of it, you know, meeting people and making connections and learning things. But in terms of the actual getting a degree, I would say that, and this is, you know, in stark contrast to the way it was 20 years ago, but I would say that I would definitely give some real thought to if this is what you want to do. But you also got to be real careful because for just as many people, it is so easy to decide not to push yourself and to not go to college and not do all these things and then end up missing out and regretting it because, you know, the things that you're able to do when you're 18, when you're 22, when you're 24, you know, don't, it's not always as easy in your life. You know, that is the perfect time to take advantage of these things. So the thing I would encourage people to do is to find a path that will make themselves as strong as possible. You know, learn skills that are going to be, that they think are going to be valuable to them. Meet people, meet a variety of people, and meet people who are doing things that they're interested in. Learn new things, force their brain to be stronger, become wiser, have it, you know, have to overcome hardship. Because the stronger you push yourself and make yourself when you're young, the better you're going to position yourself to be for, you know, when you're an old man like me.
No, I agree with you. I actually haven't seen a day of college myself. I chose not to go to college at the time because, like you said, I feel like it was something that was sort of I was obligated to do or I was forced to do. Or, you graduate high school and then you've got that one summer to yourself and then you're expected to go straight to college. And, college is something that I value a lot. I think it's an amazing opportunity. And it was something that I didn't want to waste time on and I didn't want to waste money on if I didn't want it bad enough. I don't like doing things just to do them. I have to want them. And I didn't want it bad enough then. And I was really lucky to have a family that understood and that supported me, and I was able to sort of find myself, if you could say that. And I had managed to start entry level at a company. I work for a Fortune 500 bank now, and I started off entry level, spent 6 years working on myself up through the ranks. And you didn't necessarily need a college education to get promoted; you just had to be good at what you did and have the experience. And 6 years later, I work in quality control. I do pretty well for somebody who doesn't have a college degree. And like you said, I watched people who did that. not necessarily get that happy ending. You know, they were either working jobs that had nothing to do with their degree, weren't able to find anything at all, and it just didn't seem like it made them any happier. And especially with the way the economy was lately, to do all of that, it just felt like a gamble, where it's like, I'm going to give up this job that I'm really good at and I'm making good money at, to go back to school, put all this money into it, all this time into it, and even then I may not get a job out of it. And it just felt very risky to me. So I agree with you in that that's not always the happy ending.
Now, that said, I think that you can't ever let yourself stop learning things.
Oh, of course not.
Yeah. And if you're going to, if one were ever choosing a path where they're like not pushing the school stuff more, you got to fill that with something else. Keep your brain growing. Yeah. You have to do something, because it doesn't have to be school, but if you're not using your brain, you are definitely going to fall way, way, way behind.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, but
yeah.
Well, it sounds like we're on the same page. That's right, kids. Drop out of school. It's cool. Hell yeah.
There you go. So after you received the opportunity to work at Wizards, and as your career is going really, really well, you get sent to prison. Did magic even cross your mind at this time? Like, what was going through your mind as this was happening?
What do you mean? I was working at Wizards of the Coast, and I got hit with an indictment from, activity from years prior.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously always knew it was a possibility that something could come up, but I had hoped that by being, far removed from that life that it wouldn't be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, sometimes when you're not doing things, you're no longer of value to protect for, certain people no longer want to keep you protected.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I thought about magic every single day for the 4 years that I was gone.
Mm-hmm. Did you think that you would ever play again, or?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's never a doubt. I mean, I played against myself only, but I played against, I played countless games internally. I mean, I was continuing to work, not actually work, but just contributing, consulting for free with WOTC to help them through a transitional period, but for years.
From inside?
Yeah.
Wow.
Through the mail. Absolutely. And with phones.
Wow.
Yeah. And tried to contribute as much as I could. And then I actually eventually, it wasn't until near the tail end when it looked like when I had some relative idea of when I might be able to come back, that I requested being out of the loop so that I would no longer be ineligible to play, so I could wait out the amount of time for all the different sets that I knew about ahead of time, so that I'd be able to play again when I got out.
That's interesting that they, still kept you on board throughout that time, because I can see how a company might be a little leery of that, where,
Well, people certainly didn't talk about it.
Sure.
At this point, hey, that was like, 10 years ago, and everything's great now, so.
Now, if you don't mind me asking, were you allowed to have magic things in there with you, like decks and?
I played with playing cards.
Okay.
Yeah, I played with playing cards, where I just had, I would get three decks of cards, and then one deck would have, three decks of cards, and one deck would have four extra four extra jokers and four extra kings.
Mm-hmm.
Little known trivia, by the way, in the song The Storm, the pop anthem The Storm, there's a line about four more jokers, four more kings.
Mm-hmm.
And that is in reference to playing with a deck of playing a 52 card deck of playing cards, adding four jokers and four kings so that you have 60 cards, and then just knowing what every card represents. And then if you do that for two decks, maybe the other deck you just add four jacks and four queens or something. And then you just can play, a game against yourself.
Mm-hmm. Did being there for the 4 years that you were there change your outlook on things? Or did you, or were you thinking about when you get out, you wanted to pick up exactly where you left off?
Well, I mean, exactly where I left off was working for WOTC.
Well, going back to the competitive scene as well, like, did you think as soon as I get out, I'm going to get back into that? Or were you...
It was unclear. You got to remember, back then, first of all, Magic was nowhere near as successful as it is now.
Sure.
And there were no professional Magic players.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not really. I mean, there was sort of, right? But people tried approaching it like poker.
Mm-hmm.
And Magic went through some rough periods where, some people, a few people were able to make enough money to make a good living off of Magic, but there wasn't, people weren't writing articles as much, and they weren't certainly not writing books and doing, all the different activities that are possible now. Plus just the fact that, So in 2000, like the number of people who played Magic in 2004 compared to the number of people who play Magic now, it's just mind blowing, you know? So no, I mean, like for instance, what I do now didn't even exist when I was in, when I was gone.
Sure.
But I knew, I always knew I would go to pro tours, you know, like I've never not been able to play in a pro tour. I've skipped tons of pro tours, but I've never been unable to, like qualifying has never been something that stood in the way. And so I knew I would want to do that at the very least. And who knows, you know, like I'm open to whatever possibilities come. I know that the Magic community always meant the world to me. And, you know, like I, when I was gone, I was corresponding with dozens of Magic players. You know, we'd talk decks. We'd talk just about what's going on. People would send me pictures, tournament reports. I know Mark Herberhals actually increased the amount of tournament reports he actually wrote, because if he wrote, you know, he figured if he was going to write this whole story and explain to me what happened, he might as well publish it as an article. You know?
Because the community means so much to you, were, was there a part of you that was worried what the community thought? Like, did you ever feel like maybe you were letting them down, or maybe they were going to look at you differently or anything like that?
No, I don't really. No, I've never really been big. Like, not, I guess I cared a lot when I was a kid, but like when I was younger, but I haven't really cared what, as an adult, what people think too much, particularly when you have to kind of just accept, like, for instance, I mean, I went to prison for a drug charge and was gone for 4 years. People are going to say that's, and that's just what actually happened. Like, imagine what people are going to say, because people are always going to try to expand.
Oh, I've seen the stories. They're pretty wild.
So, but why does it matter? You know,
I agree.
Like people just say stuff. Besides, it's like, it is, people talking about you is a way of showing love to you. Like it is a way of saying that you are a significant enough character in their life that they want to think about you more. They want to make you, that you are interesting to them, and they want to romanticize your story even more because they just, they want to think about it. They want to make it into something, you know, they want to make it even larger than life, or they want to, or in some way that you're providing a useful character to them, because not always are you going to be the good guy in somebody's story.
Sure.
There are a lot of people that would really, really like to have somebody, like for instance, think about how many people like to, who want to bash Miley Cyrus, right? For whatever reason, right? And no question, there's no shortage of people who have an incredible amount of positive things to say. But there are people who want her to be something negative to them. And the fact that she is willing to be that for them also, that is a, it is a powerful thing, because it doesn't take anything away from Miley Cyrus when other people want her to, like when they make her into a caricature of herself, when they want, where they, you know, and obviously she feeds into it, but the, but when somebody else wants her to be this, this cartoon character, well, how does that hurt her? When it might enrich that person's life, now their life is more interesting. They have something to talk about, something to think about, something to feel good about in relation to, or something to make somebody else seem better to them. You know, like people want to have preferences. They want some things to be good and some things to be less good. And so sometimes being that, you know, let's let somebody else experience something else more fully. So I don't really mind. Besides, I was always really misunderstood before anyway, so it's not like this is going to change anything.
Right. Do you think that's made you more popular, that the fact that you are so ambivalent towards that, you know, the good guy, the bad guy, that dichotomy?
I don't know. I don't find it super, super useful to dwell on things making people popular or whatever. I know I was super unpopular as a kid, and thinking about popularity a lot as a kid made me feel bad about myself. And I was, you know, I was very depressed and very socially awkward, very self-conscious, insecure, and very not great at the popularity game. And when I was, you know, when I was 16 getting into professional Magic, it was a life-changing experience for me. It was one of the most positive experiences in my entire life. And it gave me something to have confidence in. And it gave me something to feel okay about who I was and the skin that I was in. And I met so many other people that could actually relate to the experiences that I've been through. And I found a community that welcomed me, where I could actually connect with people without having to try to be popular, without having to, you know, without having to worry about the sort of high school cliques that exist as a kid. And I haven't looked back. You know, I would rather just.
I think it's one thing to not care about being popular. It's another to not notice that you are. Like, you have to, you are a big deal. Like, you do realize that. I mean, you have 15,000 followers. You have a huge Facebook following. You're in the Hall of Fame. People hinge on the decks that you publish. You have to be aware of that to some degree. Like, you're not just Patrick Tate around the band. I mean,
obviously, I mean, I'm certainly aware of what, like, I'm aware from a business standpoint what kind of traffic articles get or views for videos or things like that. But I mean, tell you what, perhaps here's an answer that's better for you. It's not very popular to try to be popular.
Okay. Well, I certainly don't think that you've tried to, but I think, you know, like I said, I think we can't deny that you are, and that that's something we are aware of, and there's nothing wrong with being aware of that, and I just was hoping that you would be aware of that too, and it sounds like you are, and I was just worried for a second that you weren't. So,
flattery will get you everywhere.
It's true, though. Like, I don't, I mean, you know, you have to know.
What I know is that that it means a lot to me that so many people stood up and took a strong position on a few, I guess, controversial subjects that I have, mm-hmm. and spoke up at times where it's not always easy, where sometimes it can be actually very easy to just go with the flow or to just to not say anything when you're not the one being hurt, mm-hmm. and if anything, I guess having a lot of followers or people reading articles or whatever is super appreciated when there are so many people that come out to make, for instance, the magic community more welcoming to women or to the gay, trans community or bi community or when people are more accommodating to people outside, you know, muggles, like being more welcoming to people who are not already hardcore into magic. Mm-hmm. And if anything, that's to me the thing that is to me, those are popular things. And if anything, I just like to, you know, I like that so many people are on the same page about all that.
Sure. So once you got out, how was your transition back to competitive magic? Would you say that it was pretty smooth?
Yeah, well, I don't know about smooth. It was easy for me to get back into it. Mm-hmm. But there were some challenges. When I first got back, I was in a halfway house for 6 months and couldn't travel. Like, I couldn't leave the state. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't really go to pro tournaments yet. And then as soon as I got out of there, the next pro tour was the Two-Headed Giant Pro Tour. And Mark Herberhals, bless his heart, took me on as his other head. The setup was you had to be like a certain, you know, the two teammates together had to combine to a certain level of, you know, certain levels of pro points or whatever. Mm-hmm. And Mark was the best player in the country. So he could, you know, he could have played with his mom if he wanted. So he took me, and that was my first tournament back. And then, I immediately, was able to qualify for pro tournaments. But I couldn't go to the first one in Valencia. I actually made the deck that ended up winning, but I couldn't go because it was in Spain, and I still couldn't leave the country for a long time. Mm-hmm. The next tournament, though, was in New York for the World Championships, and that was the one where Nassif Herberhals and I played Mono Red Dragonstorm.
Yeah.
And ended up finishing second at Worlds. So I guess, you know, it was very rapid. Like, I instantly, you know, first I never missed a pro tour that I could actually go to, and instantly qualified, and then instantly top eighted, and was instantly on the gravy train. Mm-hmm. And so that all worked out, but it wasn't as smooth as it could have been, because, like, you know, for instance, a year later, I got deported from Japan.
I read about that.
And, you know, there's definitely some challenges at different times being able to actually go to events. You know, the worst one was obviously by far Japan. It turns out in Japan, the system is there's like a little questionnaire when you're entering the country, and it has five different questions. One of them is, are you a felon? And apparently the answer is no.
I didn't realize this at the time. You know, I had actually before, you know, I always investigated beforehand if there'd be any issues or whatever. And I had talked to my probation officer and he said, yeah, you have no problem at all. And I was like, okay, well, in that case, you know, I'm going to Japan. And I go there and I fill out their questionnaire and I say, yes. And then they ask me about it and it's a drug charge. And I give them the details and then I get deported after 3 days of hearings and being, you know, going through quite a number of difficult circumstances. They actually had me sign a bunch of documents that were in Japanese without telling me what they said.
Whoa.
And they told me I was going to go to jail if I didn't sign them. Yeah. So I actually signed them under duress instead of my name. I just wrote under duress in cursive to make it clear if it were to ever come up in the future. But yeah. So I asked him after I got home. I was like, man, that's really weird. You told me I wasn't going to have any problems and I got deported. And he said, you got deported? Why? And I said, well, because they said, you know, that I was a felon and that you can't go enter their country if you're a convicted, you know, if you're convicted of a drug charge. And they said, my probation officer said, well, how did they know? I said, well, they asked and I told him. And he said, why did you tell him? You're a probation officer. Like, if this is just how things are done, you gotta let me know. Like, wait, what? So I went with a different strategy for Canada.
Okay.
Pro Tour Montreal. Pro Tour Montreal. You know, just a couple events ago, was in Canada, and that's the other big thing is that I wasn't allowed in Canada for a long time. You know, like Japan, they made me leave. Canada, I always knew that if I go to Canada, they make me stay. So
you couldn't leave?
Well, I didn't want to go
because
I didn't want to put myself in this position. But sure. Yeah, for a while, I mean, for the first like 7 years or whatever, I could potentially face, you know, charges there from alleged activity. But the other big thing is Canada has special restrictions regarding felons going to Canada and all this. And but, learning the lessons I learned from Japan, I went a very different avenue and got a very good immigration attorney and went through a procedure that, you know, like it took me 6 months to be able to get permission to go into Canada. And I'm still not fully authorized. The whole process takes 2 years, but I was authorized. Like I was given permission to go to Pro Tour Montreal specifically, despite the fact that my, you know, immigration proceedings are not quite completed yet.
Right. Did you have any problems getting to Dublin because of this?
No.
Okay. So it seems like it's just unique to certain countries that it's more difficult.
Very few. Yeah, there's very, very few that it actually comes up. But no, I'd done, and I actually, after the Japan thing, did very thorough research on every other country that, you know, has ever had a big magic tournament just so that I understood what I would need to do and, you know, where it would be a challenge and where not, you know.
So is this still – are there still countries where even now in 2013 and 2014 you'd still have to go through this?
I still can't go to Japan.
Oh, still?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, apparently, yeah, getting permission to go to Japan when you've had a felony drug charge is not easy.
Wow.
I think something like 24, 25 people have ever gotten permission, and one of them was a beetle. So, like, it's not – it's definitely – we're talking like $1 million operation type of thing, you know. That said, I'm certainly on the lookout for – you know, how to make that possible. And I do want to go back to Japan as soon as it is realistic and safe. Apparently, tons and tons of people go to Japan with felonies. They just say no. Because if you say no, they don't know, and then you just go.
Yeah.
They don't have any of the information. But they have my fingerprints and information and all that. And besides, I'm okay with playing the game of just doing everything by the book and being completely on the up and up and above reproach in every way. It's not easy, but there's plenty of other stuff to – like there's plenty of other games to play. You know, there's plenty of other – like I'm not attached to any one particular outcome. And I've been playing the game of trying to be above reproach for a while and – I've been happy with the results I've been getting, so I kind of want to just keep playing it, you know?
Sure. So once you regained your stride in the pro scene, you started turning your attention towards more creative endeavors. You wrote your first book, and you recorded a rap album. How did these things happen?
So Next Level Magic and The Gathering?
Yes.
First, so Next Level Magic was my first book. That was back in 2009, I want to say.
Okay.
Maybe you would know better than I. I don't know. Maybe it was 2010.
Okay.
When did Whirlwake come out?
Oh, I took a break during that time. I quit after Urza's Legacy, and I came back for Dark Ascension. So I don't know very much about the sets in between when they came out.
Yeah. So I've been talking a lot with my friend Mike Long, a Magic player from the old days that many people may know it from his notoriety. He's a good friend of mine, and I've known him since I was a kid, and he's a really awesome dude. It's tough because certainly he doesn't mesh with everybody. Mm-hmm. And part of Mike Long is knowing that he is Mike Long, you know, and as long as you're okay with Mike Long is Mike Long, and you know, he's actually a pretty incredible human being. As long as you can handle all that goes along with it, you know, like he's a very high energy guy and, can be very turbulent, but I have a huge amount of respect for him. And he talked to me a lot about, you know, sort of he imagined a future of magic media where people would be making videos, mm-hmm. and people would stream games and people would be able to do, you know, people would watch replays and people would, and this is long before there were any video articles. Mm-hmm. It's funny how many, nowadays people just take it as a given that there are magic videos.
Yeah.
There's countless magic videos. And so many of those people don't even realize that it was Mike Long who pioneered all of that, mm-hmm. you know? One of the things he always pushed for was to have somebody write a book about magic. And he always, you know, he had been telling me for years beforehand that he thought that I was the perfect guy to do it. And then finally ended up deciding to take him up on it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was definitely a success. Ended up putting out more editions of Next Level Magic. Next Level Deck Building just came out recently and is available on StarCityGames.com. Buy it now. I've really enjoyed the books. One of the big things I really enjoy about them is the permanence, the sort of this permanent piece of magic culture that continues. When I was a kid, it was just an unbelievably powerful thing reading Baxter's books. Baxter's books had such a profoundly positive impact on me, and now, despite the fact that he was advocating casting Mind Bomb, discarding a Colossus of Sardia, and then animating, deading it, and then twiddling it, the fact that there were these books about magic theory, about magic decks, I mean, I don't know that I would have ever gotten into magic as hardcore as I did if it were not for George Baxter, and he was one of the biggest influences. And it's funny because actually a lot of the stuff I was reading from Baxter's books featured Mike Long, who was one of the superstars of the game before the Pro Tour even. Uh-huh. I really love the permanence because there's so many. I mean, there's obviously magic articles. There's millions of them. But there's a real shortage of timeless magic culture in written form. Decks come and go. And tournaments, you know, there's so many tournaments, tournament results, tournament, you know. But to have a book talking about the history and talking about the theory from a, you know, larger cohesive perspective, I'm into it. Mm-hmm. I think more people should be writing books about magic. You know, I'm still waiting for Jerry Thompson to write a book or Brian Kibble or Paul, you know, like Conley. There's so many people who would be just awesome for writing books. Frank Karsten. So I'm excited for there to be even more more magic media made, and I'm excited to see stuff going down like Flores recently within the past year, I think, put out the OMG, the Official Miser's Guide, and I think Jamie Wakefield's thinking about writing something, and obviously Zvi is always a threat to, I'd like to see even more of that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that more of them aren't writing the books? Like, can you think of anything that might be stopping them?
Largely just because they don't know how to yet.
Okay.
It's a brand new thing, you know. Mm-hmm. People, and it's actually, you know, now that I know how to do it, not surprisingly, it seems much easier after having done it four times. Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest thing is that it just seems like such a daunting thing.
So tell me about the rap album.
Bill Bowden and I formed The Gathering. Bill is he's an awesome dude. He's out of the two of us, he is the one who happens to actually be musically talented. He's out in Buffalo, New York, and he read an article of mine where I did some rapping in the article and made a comment about putting out a Magic rap album next year. And he said, well, that's funny because that's what he wants to do. And he told me about his project, and he wanted me to come out and jump on a song. So I flew out to New York and recorded a song with him, you know, a single song, Innovate. And we had such a connection, and it was such a great flow that he wanted to – like such a great, you know, workflow that he wanted to do the whole album with me. And we ended up collaborating for the album The Gathering, self-titled debut album, available on iTunes. Pretty sure you can actually download it on Star City too if you want. And I love music, and I love making music. I'm not particularly musically educated. You know, like I see patterns and do math, and I know what kind of music I enjoy, and I love making music. But it is a very challenging activity, and it is a good thing that Bill knows so much about it, you know. And actually working on some other music that non-Magic related, but some other music that we're hoping to be dropping early next year. And I still fly out there a couple times a year to record music with him, you know.
You know who else is a really good rapper is Gavin Verhey.
I big hearts towards Gavin.
I would love to see a little rap battle between you two. Just saying.
That might be able to be arranged. Although he's probably better at freestyling than I am.
So you actually have to like write it down and yeah.
It depends. Like sometimes I get into a zone, but yeah, I don't like I have to be practicing. Like if I'm doing a lot of rapping for. I start becoming better able to freestyle, but when I'm not thinking in terms of rap, it isn't just naturally. I'm not just thinking in rhyme all of the time.
Okay. Yeah, because I can look at Gavin and I can look at Gavin and be like, Gavin, rap about a snowflake, and then he spits a verse about a snowflake. Like he's just that good.
Yeah.
It's pretty enviable. So in 2011, your name appeared on the Hall of Fame ballot, and you were just shy of making the cut then. What do you think it was that kept you from getting the amount of votes that you needed then?
Well, I missed by 4 votes, mm-hmm. And I would say it's because about 17 of my friends didn't vote for me.
Simple enough. when I was doing some research on you, there were some blog posts and there were some people who speculated that your prior history may have affected that first run at the Hall of Fame. And then there were also people who questioned whether or not you should even be inducted because of it. What do you think about that?
I don't know. No, I don't think a lot about it. Mm-hmm. That was never a big issue. Like, I have no doubt that there's some number of people who would use that as a rationalization, but it's a very after the fact. They kind of want to just make up a story to explain a situation. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, when I missed by 4 votes and 17 of my friends didn't vote for me, you know, an awful lot of them said they didn't think I had a chance that year, and a bunch of other people thought that you know, there's some number of people who it's because I didn't have enough Grand Prix finishes, and there's some number of people who, and you know, the Magic Hall of Fame is not a thing that anybody's entitled to,
sure.
With the perhaps exception of Luis Gavargas, John Finkel, and Kai, but like, it's not really an entitled type of thing. Like after I missed by 4 votes, I thought there was a good chance that I'd be able to get in the next year, although I didn't know that it was an exceptionally difficult year, and so I shifted my focus to. Out of the things people say, like obviously there's nothing I can do about the fact that I went to prison at this point. You know, like I try to be as positive of an influence as I can in the community, in any community I'm in. But there's not really a lot I can do in that department. You can't really worry about that or those people. And I'm not really interested in trying to just win votes. I'm more interested in if I were to ever be inducted into the Hall of Fame, it being on the merits. No politicking, no vote trading, no convincing people, no sales pitch. And yeah, I would have loved to have gotten in a year earlier, but that year I went out, top 8 at a couple more GPs, and ended up getting in the following year in an exceptionally difficult class. And it is the highest honor I have ever received. Mm-hmm. And it means the world to me. And the fact that some number of people held it against me or continue to hold it against me I don't hold it against them that they do, because when people are trying to – when they're taking on as serious of a responsibility as voting for the Magic Hall of Fame, if it matters enough to them where they are taking it seriously, one of the five categories is integrity. And another of the five categories is contributions to the game. And those things are to be defined by people in whatever way they believe, whatever, you know, whatever they think is best. And I can't like, well, I personally, I'd like to think that, I mean, obviously I don't think there's a, I can't even imagine that there's a player on the, you know, there's not a single player at the Pro Tour who would accuse me of being less than the maximum amount of integrity in the game. And as far as contributions to the game, I'd like to think that I've contributed more than I've hurt. But if somebody values those things different and has different valuations where they believe that if you – like, for instance, Sean McCowan didn't vote for me 1 year because of that. And the following year, he ended up voting for me. And part of that was getting to know me a little bit better and getting to, you know, and I guess his evaluations of how much does it matter that somebody did something at some point in the past? Can they ever be different than that person that they were 10 years ago? Mm-hmm. And, you know, to say nothing of how bad you may think it actually is, whatever, you know, anything I did in my youth. But no, I think I can't hold it against anybody who in their investigating people's integrity or contributions to the game feel that that is a strike that should be either held against me or even a deal breaker. You know, I can't hold it against them.
You made it clear after you were inducted into the 2012 Hall of Fame that you still have the goal of wanting to win a Pro Tour. What is it about that particular goal that still inspires you?
Well, I mean, probably the number one thing being that I haven't done it yet. But I really want to win. You know, I won the vintage – I won the Type 1 championships, and I won Michigan State championships, and I've won team competitions. And there's no shortage of, you know, I've won plenty of tournaments, but it's not the same thing as the Pro Tour and honestly the World Championships, particularly since when I came in second to the World Championships, being so close and it's still haunting me, you know. I occasionally wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning wanting to know why I blocked Doran or, you know, like things I could have done. And I guess when you win, you couldn't have done any better.
Right.
That's the best. And so winning a Pro Tour, that is the best you could possibly do on that week, you know?
So let's say you get your Pro Tour win and you achieve your goal. What do you have to look forward to after that? What do you shoot for next?
I guess the winning the world championship.
And then let's say you get that.
Now that the world championship and a Pro Tour are two separate things, you know.
And then let's say you achieve that. Are you always going to be striving, or do you? Because part of the thing I worry about is I feel like I see, a number of people in recent years to get into the Hall of Fame, and we don't. You know, when I was going through the Hall of Fame to research you, and even when I had Kibler on my show and I researched him and I had Finkel on my show and I looked him up, there were a lot of names there that I don't see anymore. And I do sometimes.
You don't see Finkel and Kibler anymore?
No, not them. But there were other names in other classes that I don't really see anymore. And it does. I don't have them on me, but I just remember at the time thinking I don't know who these people are. I haven't seen them around.
Well, some of them. I think that's largely because many of those people, like, for instance, the Hall of Fame class that I got in with, there's Paulo, Kenji, and Oiso. And Paulo obviously is still at all the events. Kenji and Oiso had been retired for years before they got inducted. Mm-hmm. So you got to remember, with the Hall of Fame, a lot of people who get into the Hall of Fame are already years removed from the game. Mm-hmm. And so it's not even just that they're not around. They weren't around before. Mm-hmm. The Hall of Fame does bring some people back. Like, for instance, look at Kai and John.
Yeah.
Ty and John are two people. And now, actually, at the most recent Pro Tour, there's Frank Karsten, John Finkel, Kai, Kibler coming back. The number of people – and now Kibler came back before the Hall of Fame, obviously. But the number of people who are – the number of Hall of Famers who played in the last Pro Tour was actually pretty astounding. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'd love to see even more. But I do think that there is an experience, though, the Hall of Fame curse.
Right.
Which is for instance, Luis Scott Vargas is the most recent, I guess, beneficiary of. But the Paulo and myself did not have our best year ever last year. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean we're not going to come back with the Thunder. Like, I mean, I've finished ninth at the last Pro Tour. You know, like, you're going to have ups and downs, and it can be very easy to build this narrative where it's like, oh, well, because Paul, and there is some truth to it, which is that before you're in the Hall of Fame, you want to push yourself in every possible way because it's such an unbelievably difficult and elite thing to try to get into. And then when you no longer have that pressure of having to do well to stay on the tournament, you can just enjoy yourself. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit less pressure and there's a little bit more, like, for instance, I mean, I just got married. And I'm working on, you know, I'm doing a lot of things, and I'm still very, very, you know, I spend more than 40 hours a week with Magic, but it's nice to not have that pressure of, for instance, it mattering if you platinum or not, you know?
Well, I guess what I was trying to say is I like the fact that you're, you know, you were inducted and you still have things you want to achieve and you're still going. I think that's great.
I'm still
going to
be playing in Pro Tours when I'm 70.
Fantastic. You're just gonna have somebody changing your colostomy bag in between rounds.
No, you wouldn't believe the technology we have in the future.
Fantastic. So the last thing I want to talk about is you did mention the book that you just recently released, Next Level Deck Building, and you are widely known as the innovator. So tell me about the book and how important being innovative is to you.
So the book Next Level Deck Building is about my favorite subject in Magic Theory, which is deck building. there's a real shortage of comprehensive material on deck building, and it is the subject that I get asked about the most that you can't really answer in a paragraph, you know. And it covers everything from building a mana base to every different type of deck to every good deck that's ever been built to every good deck builder from, you know, from the past, like the 100 best deck builders to like how to beat different types of decks, how to sideboard, how to build a sideboard, how to look at a metagame and figure out how to evolve the decks to be better for next week, how to I mean, there's countless areas and they're all covered. And it's really just a labor of love because it's something that I enjoy so much. And yeah, it came out a few months ago. And if deck building is a subject you're interested in, and it's not just for people who want to, you know, build a brand new deck, although that is definitely one of the big themes. There's also a lot of people, you know, who will just want to win a tournament. And understanding how to read a metagame and understanding how to tune a deck and understanding how to pick a deck and understanding how to position yourself in a format, those are all skills that tie into deck building and that anybody who's serious about tournament play would benefit from. And then on the other side of it, a lot of people, I get asked about Commander deck building a fair bit, and Commander is this awesome format where there is so much room to build decks. You know, there's so much room to be innovative because of, you know, playing 100 different cards. When you have to play nothing but one ofs, it's like there's so much more diversity between the different decks, and there's so many different cards that people can play with, and the goals of the format are a little bit different. And it's another format, though, that benefits greatly from understanding deck building more so that you get the most out of your experience. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we're seeing enough innovation in the community right now, or do you think things could stand to be better?
Well, better, like, that's kind of loaded language. I've for many years believed that there is a real shortage of innovation with regards to deck building and not just deck building, with all sorts of things. Whenever people want to try to make things better, compared to what there should be, because of how should be, as in what the game would like, what where it would be profitable. Uh-huh. Like right now, there is such an incredible reward if you're a good deck builder, and if you come up with innovative designs, And they're such an incredible reward if you're an innovative TO. And being innovative as a judge, being innovative as a TO, being innovative as a dealer, being innovative as a deck builder, and being innovative as a magic writer. I mean, all these areas, there's so many places where people can be innovative and make things better by trying more things and being fearless, being okay with failing sometimes. And looking for that one idea out of 10 or one idea out of 20 that hits, you know, that hits a home run, and suddenly the whole community is better. You know, like for instance, the sleep-in specials. Somebody innovated sleep-in specials, and now Grand Prix are better. Uh-huh. And with deck building, it is like look at this most recent format. Look at the decks people play now compared to the decks people played a month ago. Uh-huh. I mean, a month ago, how many people were playing devotion decks, devotion to, you know, playing the different gods, playing the equipment, playing the trident and all that, or playing, you know, mono black or black white, or, you know, like the game, like the formats are so different now, and it's so quickly people just assume like, yeah, obviously you just do this. But a month ago, nobody was doing that. And the people who did that, oh my gosh, like look at the last Pro Tour. Look how the people who figured out devotion to blue, uh-huh. the people who figured out to play the Nykthos decks, the people who figured out to play Desecration Demon, Thoughtseize, and Hero's Downfall. It's like, it seems so clear to me just how incredibly beneficial it is to be one of those people. And there are an awful lot of people who are just content to play whatever did well last week. Uh-huh. And there's nothing wrong with that, but my God, the people who are willing to cut blaze new trails, they are, and it's, you know, it's great for them, but it's also great for the rest of the game, you know? Uh-huh. And I'd love to see more of it. Deck building was kind of at a low about 4 years ago. Uh-huh. But I do think that there's been a rebound. There's been a resurgence in interest in people in making real decks and making good decks and tuning decks and evolving things. And it's partly because of people like Jerry Thompson or Brian Kibler or Sam Black or Justin, there's so many people, you know, Raptor and like
Conley.
Definitely. Yeah. Oh my gosh. No, Conley was one of the people who was doing it 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Conley was one of the people who was doing it. I mean, I still remember at Grand Prix Denver. This is back like, I don't know, 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I was on a podcast where somebody was talking to me about deck building. And one of the subjects they asked me about was the best deck builders in the world. And in this person's estimation, Conley was one of the five best deck builders in the world. And I didn't know who Conley Woods was. This was before he was on the Pro Tour, you know, before he was doing anything. You know, like I think he had been at a Pro Tour or two, but this is before he had made his move. And he said, you watch, he's going to take over. He's going to be world famous for his deck building. He's that good. And he was not wrong.
Yeah. I remember when I saw him at Pro Tour Gate Crash, and I was sick in bed that weekend, and that was when he played the mostly black control with Grizzlebrand and Cryptghast. And I've always been a big fan of black, and I remember being sick in bed, and I was just generally grumpy, and I wasn't really liking anything that I saw. And I remember when I saw that deck, and I saw the deck tech, and I remember sitting up in bed and going, oh my god, he's using Cryptghast. And then just when I thought it couldn't get any better, he's using four Gloom Surgeons. And I remember being on Twitter, and people would be like, Conley is lost his mind. Like, why is he using it? I'm like, you shut up. I love Gloom Surgeon. And I remember racing to TCG Player and I didn't even play it, test it. I was like, I need that deck. I was like, I love that. And I bought the two Grizzlebrands that I needed, and I bought the Rakdos Returns that I needed. And I fell in love with that. And that was one of those moments where I was like, no one's doing that anymore. Like, no one's using those crazy cards and making it work like that. And I had a lot of respect for him, and I became a big fan of his after that. And I admit the deck didn't do so well in my hands once I got it, but I just had never seen anything like that, and I wish there was more of that.
Yeah, and I think we're at least moving in a good direction.
Yeah.
My goodness, are we far behind of where we used to be 15 years ago in terms of people blazing new trails, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just it's awesome when somebody has in their range every card. Mm-hmm. They're willing to play anything, whatever they think is the, you know, whatever it takes. Because so many people can only imagine themselves playing the very best cards, the very most popular cards. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, the whole idea of the best cards, because, I mean, how much do people think that did people think that Erebos was one of the best cards, or Grey Merchant? You know, how good was Grey Merchant a month ago? And now it's, oh yeah, it's just the best deck, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I enjoy Grey Merchant myself, but I had to put it down recently because my local meta, it wasn't doing so well. So I'm on a junk mid-range train right now, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's different. It's fun. It feels good in my hands. I like it. So.
And you have to admit, in recent years, there have been a fair number of rogue decks doing well, you know, mm-hmm. like the Aristocrats and with the obviously we just mentioned, you know, Mono Black and all the Devotion decks. And I think basically, I mean, obviously in Modern, all the decks are terrible. Like Modern, it's all just old derivative decks that are terrible anyway. And in Block, every Block format sucks. I mean, it's fun to play, but you don't exactly get super rich, diverse metagames. But Standard has had some pretty sweet decks, and I wish people would make even more of them. I mean, there's no question to me that we still are not even scratching the surface of what's possible in these formats.
You mean like Grixis? Where is Grixis, no. Patrick Chapin?
Grixis is hiding under a rock waiting for his revelation to go away. All of the things that the sheer volume of things that have been printed to try to make Sphinx's Revelation bad that are also good against Grixis is disheartening. Mm-hmm. And Sphinx's Revelation is so much more powerful than anything Grixis has access to. Mm-hmm. It's just, it can be very difficult to, plus I'm kind of on a, like I haven't top aided a Pro Tour in a couple years. So I want to go ahead and knock one of those out, maybe win this one. Mm-hmm. So I'm not like, I'm completely sold out. Like I played Black White at the last tournament. I'll play anything. I'll play Mono Red. I don't like, to put it bluntly, I don't give a fuck.
And I can't think of a better way to close out the show. So Patrick, if people have enjoyed your appearance here, how can they get a hold of you? Where can they find you?
I'm on Twitter, mm-hmm. the P Chapin. I'm on Star City, like, I don't know, 74 times a month. My name's Patrick Chapin on Star City. On Facebook, you can find Patrick Chapin, the Innovator, if you want to. I don't really use Facebook a ton, but I like to post deck lists the day after a tournament or whatever there, and that's a good spot for it. You can show up at my house and be a creepy stalker. I'm not going to tell you where that is, though. You're going to have to do your homework if you want to figure that one out. But beyond that, I'd say Twitter is probably the best way. You know, Twitter is the easiest way to actually get in touch with me in a short time period.
Mm-hmm. And you do have the two books that they can purchase through Star City?
Definitely.
Okay.
Star City Games. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I would just Next Level Magic, Next Level Deck Building, and obviously The Gathering, too. Like, highly recommend it. Besides, if you want, you can go to YouTube and check out our music videos.
There are music videos, too?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, my.
I have no idea how many views they're up to, but I think Jason Mind Sculptor has like 116,000 or something.
Wow. I'll have to check that out while I'm doing laundry tonight,
yeah,
for sure.
The hit single, that banger from 2000, God, I don't even know, 2011 maybe?
Oh, wow. Well, Patrick, it has certainly been a joy having you on, and I really do appreciate you bearing with me through this and helping me out with this. And I it's been really glad. It's been great getting to know you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. You'll have to have me back sometime.
I would love to. I mean, my goodness. How can I say no to Patrick Chapin?
But there's a catch.
Uh-oh.
The next time I come back, we got to film this in person. Or not necessarily film it, but just record in person. We're in the same room.
Okay.
And there has to be an incredible amount of, like, see, I don't think any podcast has ever done this before, but I'm picturing Jello wrestling. We need people to be Jello wrestling while we're recording, and so we can just watch the Jello wrestling take place.
I'm pretty sure I could get some of my listeners to do it. I'm a pretty wild girl, Patrick, so it wouldn't be hard for me to arrange.
You set it up. I'm going to be at tons of GPs this year, you know? And PTs. It sounds like now they're open. I don't know how much Jello you can bring to a PT, but Yeah, there's what GPs are close to wherever what GPs are close to you?
Well, I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I'll admit that I'm out of vacation time for the rest of 2013. So I'm kind of grounded in terms of 2013. But with 2014, my company just recently announced that they're giving us an extra week of vacation. So I'll have 3 weeks of vacation. And I planned on hitting the GPs hard. I will be a GP Philly next year. I'll be a GP Chicago next year. There's been talk.
Any of those standard?
Yes, those are GP Philly is sealed. It's Born of the Gods sealed. Chicago is standard. GP Nashville is team sealed. That's in October of next year. I'll be going to that because I love team sealed. There's been talk of me going out to GP or Portland for the other team sealed. So I plan on getting my travel on next year.
Well, I'll tell you what, I don't know for sure which sealed ones I'm going to be at or not. In the words of Brian Kibler, I don't go to limited GPs anymore. But I will definitely be at the standard ones. Okay. So if you want to set it up for Chicago, if you can find us some Jello wrestlers. it can't just be the same two people. They're going to get tired because we need Jello wrestling continuously. When the Jello wrestling stops, the podcast is over. Dropping the mic, walking out.
Okay, you've got yourself a deal. And if anyone else is listening to the show and you've enjoyed what you've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on legitmtg.com. You can subscribe and listen to the show on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Feel free to leave me a review and some stars. The show is also on Twitter at the Deck Tees. I am on Twitter at Original Estrus, OriginalOestrus. And you can email me directly at estrus@elitistjerks.com. Thank you guys so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves.
Wait,
okay?
Is this an innuendo?
What is?
I just realized, wait, the Deck Tees. What kind of a show is this?
A fun show and an interview-style show and a professional show and an enjoyable show.
Yeah, but there isn't any video.
No. I said you could turn your cam on, but I did not.
I don't want to be the tease.
You've given me so much, though. I can't accuse you of being a tease.
All right, well, we'll have to get some video or something for the Jello wrestling
segment.
Yeah,
I mean, you can't not. I mean, you can't just have audio Jello wrestling.
Yeah, that would be a little weird.
I mean, they would just hear, like, slapping and grunts and messiness and, yeah.